Hello, everyone, and welcome. My name is Frank Rude, and I'm here with my friend and colleague Ergun Hamza. We both of us welcome you to the new episode of the Crisis and Critique podcast, Philosophy and Its Other Scene. We have a very special guest, a friend very dear to us, with us today, namely Catherine Malabou. Catherine Malabou is one of the, I mean, obviously, most well-known French thinkers of the contemporary world. She is professor at the Center for Research in Modern European Philosophy at Kingston University, professor of philosophy at the European Graduate School, and professor in the Department of Comparative Literature at the University of California, Irvine, a position that previously was held by her PhD advisor, or as we say in Germany, Dr. Vater, Jacques Derrida. She's also, some of you might not know this, but a member of the editorial committee of a wonderful journal that you should read, namely Crisis and Critique. I'm just going to mention a number of her early and most recent publications, and then I give the floor and word to Argon for the first question. One of her early publications, and if you have not looked at it, it is absolutely mandatory reading for anyone in philosophy, namely The Future of Hegel, Plasticity, Temporality, and Dialectic. It was translated in 2004, originally it appeared in 1996. In 2004, in English, also Traveling with Jacques Derrida, that's Stanford University Press. 2012, The Heidegger Change on the Fantastic in Philosophy. The absolutely monumental What Should We Do with Our Brain in 2009, Plasticity at the Dusk of Writing, Dialectic Deconstruction. In 2009 as well, The Newly Wounded from Neurosis to Brain Damage, Fordham University Press in 2012. And the most recent publications include Before Tomorrow, Epigenesis and Rationality, that's Polity Press in 2016, Morphing Intelligence from IQ Measurement to Artificial Brains in 2019, Columbia University Press. Pleasure Erased, The Clitoris and Thought, again, Polity 2022, and Stop Thief, Anarchism and Philosophy, plus Plasticity and The Promise of Explosion are the most recent ones in English. A tremendous oeuvre, one cannot say anything but this. All this demands engagement and to be read. We're honored that she's with us, and I shut up now and give the floor to Argon for the first question.
Thank you, Frank. Catherine, it's great to have you on our podcast. So let us begin with your latest publication in English that Frank just mentioned, Stop Thief, Anarchism and Philosophy. This is the thing, which came out in late 2023. This book seeks to provide a counter philosophical rethinking of anarchism. It seems to move, so to speak, on two levels. First, by, as you say, dissociating anarchism from anarchy. Here you engage with the work of contemporary philosophers such as Rancière, Derrida, Schurman, Levinas, Foucault, and Agamben. And you diagnose that, I'm quoting, although they all accord anarchy a critical value, be it ontological, ethical, or political, they fail to truly engage in philosophy of anarchism, end quote. And your goal is to interrogate the anarchist failure of philosophical concepts of anarchism. So our first question here would be, how do you differentiate your take on anarchism from their take on anarchy? And the second level relates to what it means to be an anarchist today in an epoch in which, as you say, horizontality is in crisis. So our second question here would be, what does it mean philosophically to be an anarchist today in a situation in which we could say that politics proper is also in crisis? Is anarchism an attempt to revitalize politics itself?
Thank you so much, Agon. So first of all, I want to say how much how honored and pleased I am to do this podcast with you, and thank you for having me. Yes, I have in the last book, I have gathered all the important concepts of anarchy developed by the most prominent contemporary thinkers, mainly Schumann, Levinas, Foucault, Derrida, Agamben, and Rancière, who all once again have a strong concept of anarchy, but I noticed that they never went as far as to declare themselves anarchists, even if they seem to be adamant on the fact that what has been called principles in the history of metaphysics, in the history of philosophy, and the history of politics, principles meaning overarching values and commandments and let's say axiological directions for actions. So all of them think and write and say that principles are exhausted today. So they say it in different manners, but anyway, the conclusion is the same. So anarchy, as you know, means precisely without principle, literally, and principle means commandment and beginning. So no origin and no principles. So in that sense, they're very close to political anarchism, and yet at the same time, as I said, they never make the leap toward political anarchism that they judge to be too metaphysical, too idealist, and mostly, I mean, the term that comes back over and over is impossible. Anarchism as a political organization would be impossible because either too naive or, on the contrary, too violent. So I try to examine this strange position because you cannot develop a concept of anarchy without referring in a way or another to anarchism. It's impossible. It's not any name. You know, you don't come up with this word anarchy without having in mind something like anarchism. So I interpreted this strange position as a denial or a disavowal. And I tried to understand disavowal of what? What exactly was this gesture of, on the one hand, stealing the ideas from anarchism, like the end of principles, etc., and on the other, saying, oh, no, but we are not anarchists. So I interpreted it as a gesture of disavowal. Disavowal of what? What is the question that the philosophers, even if very radical, what is the question that they were not, in my view, able to be confronted with? I think very simply, it is what Proudhon calls the governmental prejudice. That is the idea that it is possible to live politically without being governed. It seems very simple, but in fact, it is a very tricky question. Is a political life possible without being governed and without governing the others? And on that point, because initially anarchism is, about the government. It's very clear in Proudhon, the state, of course, plays a role in anarchism, the critique of the state. But more precisely, and this is the big difference with Marxism, anarchism is really about being governed. It's about the question of domination. And anarchism is, yes, it's thought of as a form of community, of being together without a government. And this question, in my view, is something on which all philosophers have stumbled, including Derrida. He never deconstructed the idea of government. And I tried to demonstrate that for each of them. So that's what I tried to do in the book. So, just to conclude on that point, anarchy in philosophy means the result of the deconstruction of metaphysics. And anarchism means a political movement, and both cannot be reconciled. I mean, if we read the political philosophers of the 20th century. Now, about what is it to be an anarchist today? I mean, in a certain sense, I didn't even have to ask myself the question, because anarchism is everywhere. That's the beginning of my book. And not because we would see anarchists everywhere on the streets, but because capitalism itself is accomplishing an anarchistic turn by promoting values of libertarianism, cyber capitalism, cyber anarchism. The last face of this horror we saw was that of the Argentinian president with a chainsaw, like, let's cut through the state and suppress ministers, etc. We are libertarians, and the party is called Advanced Libertarians in Spanish. And so clearly, capitalism, it's another theft, has stolen the main ideas of anarchism and are using them to justify the general uberization of life, this horizontality that we see everywhere. So in a certain sense, and strangely enough, I came to anarchism through the contrary to anarchism, that is the capitalistic use of it. And I started to reflect what exactly are they stealing? And yes, this is also this idea that a life without a government is possible. Except that in the from the capitalist point of view, this is an illusion, of course. This is what they tend to make us believe. But they are stealing this idea. And so I started to get interested in the tradition of anarchism, reading text and starting to think. And it came to my mind that maybe it wasn't possible any longer to oppose this capitalist anarchism from outside, that is by opposing it a kind of external position, let's say socialist, more or less socialist. But maybe to situate ourselves on the same ground. Okay, you're talking about horizontality. We're not going to let you steal our horizontality. You know, trying to walk on the same ground and develop a form of opposition that is not external but internal. So this is what I would say right now.
Thank you so much. I think the point that you just made with, let's say, the history of philosophy not having really deconstructed the idea of government on the one side, and almost in a problematic way, capitalism having deconstructed
in a very problematic way
the idea of government.
Even if, of course, we have very authoritarian governments, it's not antagonistic. You can have a very authoritarian government, but that is just an empty form. Just the form of the police. And behind this empty form, you have this kind of horizontality. Look at what Trump says. Well, we don't need to pay taxes. We don't need the control of the state. We don't need, you know.
I mean, that shows the pressing nature of the problem, or the pressing and the intricate nature of the problem you raise, because you point out, and this is moving to the second question, you point out that philosophy somehow tried to think without principle, the absence of principles, but fell short to put this into practice, or to think what a practice of being unprincipled, of being without principle. Maybe one could say even being without the principle of being could be. And on the other hand side, so that's, there's a theory practice blockage almost, one, right?
It's also reciprocal, because anarchists themselves hate philosophy, so we should write second book to I've been accused of being just an intellectual anarchist, you know, like. So the divide theory practice is very strong, and this is something we have to overcome. This is totally stupid. I mean, this is
But you seem to make that link, the theory practice link, seems to have something to do with the move from being, from thinking, or from the principle of being. From moving it from there to forms of life, or to the concept of life, that seems to be, for you to establish what is needed to change the ground. Can you say something about why the, let's say, the concept of life or the form of life can do exactly this? To be, on the one hand side, faithful to the idea that philosophy thinks without grounds, without principles, without guarantee, so to speak, and on the other hand side, actually makes the move from theory to practice.
Yes, that's a very interesting question. And In a certain sense, this is what Agamben has tried to do by developing these notions of forms of life and also by developing a strong concept of anarchy. But this is not how I see things, because a form of life for Agamben is fundamentally destituent and impotent, impotentiality, as you know, etc. So there's a strong critique of the notion of praxis, understood as action. If I may say, my view of life is more something like a weapon, that is life understood as a deconstructive tool of any form of government. And I took this idea, strangely enough, to Foucault, the last Foucault, who for many people is making a turn to liberalism, etc. For me, it's not absolutely not the case. What he says about Diogenes and cynicism, where he shows that, in fact, this is in the seminar, The Courage of Truth, Diogenes has transformed his life into an instrument of resistance. And Foucault says this is the anarchistic turn in Greek wisdom. This is what Diogenes opposes to Plato, that in fact, life is not only the soul, because the soul is always a government. Life is also the totality of a soul and a body forming this kind of, yes, weapon of resistance, which is okay. What is life then? Life is a kind of a manifestation of itself. We have nothing to hide. And in that sense, by having nothing to hide, we're exposing the truth. And as you know, when the truth is exposed in this form, what Foucault calls paresia, it becomes very dangerous for power. So I worked on that. I worked on this notion developed by Foucault in the last seminar.
Let's stay a little bit longer in this topic, if we may. In an interview we did for Christ and Critique Journal, I think we did it in 2021. You were still working on the Stop Thief okay. manuscript, if you're not wrong. In that interview, you said the following, and let me quote you here. I do think that the concept of class struggle remains central in anarchism, but only if economic exploitation is coupled with a critique of domination and the abuse. Domination for anarchists starts with a government, be it political or simply domestic. This relates to what you said earlier. So what we are trying to ask is, what is the relation between anarchism and Marxism, if there is one? Because you said, you examine, and I quote this wonderful sentence, if I may, the sarcasm with which Marx and Engels ridiculed and marginalized anarchism has not yet been subject to deconstruction. So another question within this question would be, can anarchism still mobilize something of both Marx and Marxism, or is anarchism the only way to learn from the tremendous, catastrophic failures of Marxism in the 20th century?
Yes, no, thank you so much. That's a very important question. As you know, I mean, the divorce between both Marxism and anarchism started very early during the First International, where Bakunin and Marx couldn't agree on how to talk to the people. Marx defending a conception of the party discipline, that we need leaders, we need mediators to address the people, and Bakunin saying, on the contrary, no, we need assemblies, and we need to go freely from one assembly to the other, but we contest the idea of leaders. So it started like that. Of course, there are many, many common points between the two traditions, absolutely. Scientific socialism, I think, was Kropotkin's denomination of anarchism. So there are many nominations that are appellations that are close. So, but I knew I had to do more on that point. So in my last book that just came out in France, like two days ago, which is a commentary of Proudhon, What is Property? I understood that perhaps the most vital common point was the critique of private property in both traditions. And I started to work on this concept of theft, this time related to property. Property is theft. And Marx, in many texts, in particular the Holy Family, but also in his articles on wood theft, you know, when the states privatized the commons and forbid people to gather wood for themselves. So the motive of the theft is very central in Marx, but he accuses Proudhon to be too naive when stating property is theft, because Marx's argument is, in order to have a theft, you have to have a property first. So property cannot be a theft because it presupposes property. And what he disagrees with is the idea, we could say in modern term, that property is a performative. This is exactly what it is for Proudhon, that the invention of private property that occurred during the French Revolution, the notion of private property is very linked with the French Revolution, was a performative. That is, yes, an event as a theft that erased everything that was existing before. And on that point, Marx fundamentally disagreed by saying, no, property, private property, capitalism in other terms, cannot start as a performative. We need to understand that there's a need for what he calls, as you know, a primitive accumulation. That private property has a long genesis. And this is what anarchists disagree with, that capitalism is a blow, which doesn't mean that it doesn't have a history, but that capitalism has the power to hide its own history and to appear as, for example, a theft in its full performativity, as if there was nothing before. And this is the structure of domination, to erase people's memory and appear as something new. And I think that on that point, Marxism and anarchism fundamentally disagree. Marxism is always captured, so to speak, by the obsession of genesis. Because for Marx, as we know, the genesis of capitalism can only be economic, never political. And precisely what anarchists object to that is, no, economy, of course, plays a central role, of course, and Proudhon's book is about labor, so, but fundamentally, the nature of capitalism, the how it works, is political. Meaning by that, it has the capacity to appear as a performative, as a blow. And this is, in my view, what Marx doesn't really see. And if you don't see that, you cannot really understand what domination is. Domination starts when you are hit by something, and at the same time, you cannot understand why. You know, this is the nature of domination, a pure performative of the blow. So yeah, this is, in my view, I mean, is one of the fundamental disagreements.
I think that, I mean, that's a very powerful and interesting account of, let's say, capitalism's emergence as almost like a traumatic event, one could say. Right?
Exactly, like a trauma, exactly. Property is theft, meaning, because it is a theft of nothing.
Yeah.
You know, this is what Marx does not want to see. He says, no, there must be something before. Proudhon, you're contradictory. There must be something before. No, precisely, Proudhon says, it's a theft of nothing.
And which, a theft of nothing, which then, I mean, just as you indicated a moment ago, undoes its own prehistory, one could say.
Exactly, exactly.
And thereby, I think the question that we wanted to raise next is already sort of on the table, because the idea that one can undo the very history of an event, and thereby the performative works in both directions, takes us directly to something, a thinker like Hegel, right? Who on the one hand side could be qualified as if we look at standard readings of his political philosophy as the non-anarchist par excellence, right? In the worst cliches as state thinker, that's all untrue, but we know, but nevertheless, this is what we wanted to raise as a question. How does this very complex account that you give of capitalism as a performative event that is doing something but also undoing something, how does that relate? One can see why this complexifies immediately your take on anarchism, right? Because it goes in. And how does that relate to your account of Hegel? How does Hegel come in there?
But for sure, you gave me the word, for sure, yes, Proudhon understands the theft as a trauma. And anarchism is, let's not try to recuperate the memory. It's too late. Let's do with the trauma. Let's start with the trauma that is with the absence of commencement, the absence of beginning. Yeah, so thank you for the word trauma. I think this is exactly what Proudhon says. So Hegel, of course, I was myself surprised, oh my God, I started to, my career by working on Hegel, and now I'm interested in anarchism and how can both be compatible. At the same time, I would say two things. First of all, that I know for many people this will be a provocation, this will be provocative, but for me, there's a fundamental nonviolence in Hegel. I was rereading The Doctrine of the Concept, in which he says that the concept is never in a violent position vis-a-vis alterity. So, the concept is never a weapon for Hegel. So first of all, I think this is very important. The way in which the system works is always a way to do justice to the real, never to attack it. Which of course doesn't mean that Hegel doesn't think violence. He knows that history is violent, but the way to approach it is never violent. And I think this is extremely important. And the second thing, which is perhaps even more important, is that there is no authority for Hegel. It does not start, as we know, he says right from the beginning that there's no beginning, that no one is there to tell us how to think, that we don't have any principles, at least at the very least, we have presuppositions, but as we know, presuppositions dissolve themselves in the process. So Hegel is the first thinker, in my view, to affirm that rationality has no principles, that no authority is there, be it religious, philosophical, ethical, and that we have to do with that. And that starting, beginning is the most difficult thing. And this is an anarchist statement. So in that sense, there is a kind of anarchism of the system. That is, what is anarchism? It's the capacity of a system to organize itself out of the absence of principles. The problem is that, yes, Hegel was, in a certain sense, tempted by seeing this as the supreme form of mastery. Unfortunately, I think he concluded that this capacity organizing oneself in the absence of all authority is the supreme form of mastery. But we can also have a totally different reading and draw Hegel from the other side. You see, so in fact, it is perhaps not that contradictory.
Can we move to another topic? Yeah, namely, to the pleasure erase the clitoris unfold, yes. Which is a book of yours that has been, again, recently translated to English. It is a book about the material space of the feminine that, as you say, has been thus far representatively neglected or eradicated or erased from the history of, for example, of philosophy as such. In what sense is the feminine paradigmatically linked to a specific organ that has been underthematized, and in what sense it is somehow materially embodied, so to say?
Yes. Thank you very much for this question. I would say there are two ways of answering, like with, let's say, traditional feminism and more contemporary feminism. So in the perspective of, let's say, more traditional feminism, by that I mean the second feminism from Beauvoir up to Irigaray. It is true that the clitoris was analyzed as the organ that had always been repressed by religion, by patriarchy, by ethical values, etc. Because the fact that the woman has two genital organs, so to speak, has always been a problem from the patriarchal point of view. And it appears very early in Freud that maturity for a woman necessarily necessitates the passage from clitoral pleasure to reproduction, that is to the vagina. To be a mature woman is to stop practicing clitoral pleasure and discovering what Freud calls vaginal pleasure. So this is this kind of negation, disavowal here again of the organ of the clitoris, which in fact is only made for pleasure and has no role in biology, like no reproductive role. This is the this oppression that the feminism of the second generation has thematized and challenged, also addressing the problem of genital mutilations. What is the problem is the existence of an organ that serves no goal outside pleasure. Then in more recent terms, contemporary feminists don't assimilate the feminine with the woman necessarily, which was the case in the second generation feminism I just talked about. The feminine became a much more larger concept, including all forms of bodies and conduct, rejecting domination precisely. And it can include, of course, some masculine models, transgender people, et cetera, et cetera. So the feminine has become a much larger denomination. And the clitoris, from that point of view, as Preciado says, is not necessarily a sexual organ, but a political locus of anarchism, that something that cannot be governed, something that cannot be penetrated, governed, mastered, and that plays its own it's autonomous. So there are two epochs in this story, which means that.
I mean, as a spin-off on that that seems to indicate that the complicated argument that you're making is, how does one think an autonomous organ?
Yeah,
if I understand
autonomous
correctly.
meaning not necessarily linked with the sexual difference.
In this sense, I mean, when you say just in the book, you say the clitoris, anarchy, and feminine are indissolubly linked. They form a resistant front aware of the authoritarian tendencies of resistance itself. So, right, I mean, it is not that you're simply pitting the feminine against the masculine.
So no. I never did that anyway.
I know, but you're indicating that one has to think. I mean, what you just described in terms of there's an organ of pure pleasure. I mean,
yes.
That almost sounds, I mean, that's a very Hegelian formulation, one could say, right? It's almost like a concrete universal that is neither simply on the side of like the feminine or the masculine. It's not pitting one against the other. I mean, can you say a bit more about how this concrete universality, concrete universal, an organ that is self-sustained almost, self-sustaining and fulfills a function that is not goal-oriented vis-a-vis the organism of which it is an organ, how that relates to anarchism? Because that seems to be, right, to say something about, let's say, the economy and politicality of anarchism itself, of can you clarify this a bit more? Because it's a very intricate idea.
So very simply, first of all, there are, well, many books were recently published about sexuality. What is sexuality in terms of, no, sexuality cannot be reduced to penetration. There is today, obviously, a new exploration of the erotic capacities of the bodies, in the plural, any bodies, anybody. I mean, it includes all forms of genders and sexual behaviors, etc. So there is clearly today a re-exploration of eroticism and the erotic capacities that for centuries have been repressed. So to say that sexuality cannot be limited to penetration means that penetration necessarily implies the relationship, it is obvious, between passivity and activity. If sexuality is not reduced to penetration, it means that the couple activity passivity explodes. And this is what is emancipatory, that pleasure doesn't have to be induced by a command. It cannot be, pleasure doesn't have to be passive. It doesn't have to be the passive answer to a command, or reciprocally, the pleasure of the command itself. So we are getting out with the clitoris, understood as an organ of pure pleasure that is not penetrable. We are getting out of the activity-passivity thing. And I think that politically is very important, because it means we are getting out of the ruling, obeying dualism.
In another book of yours, which personally I like very, very, very much, in Changing Difference, the feminine and the question of philosophy, you distinguish between two types of feminism, namely the traditional and post-feminist feminism. In your description, the former is continental, whereas the latter is more Anglo-Saxon or American. This division can be described, and I'm just connecting to what you said earlier, like can be described also differently as marking the difference between sex and gender. The way you set the premise of the book is as follows. We begin here with philosophy, asking what for a woman is the life of a philosopher. There you begin from your experience as a philosopher, and you move beyond the dispute over essentialisms and anti-essentialism. Is there or is there not a specificity or essence of what is a woman, etc. Then you go on to argue that more important than sexual difference, what you said, is a difference between women. Could you elucidate this a little bit, this point a little bit for us?
First of all, if you allow me to say a few words about essence and essentialism.
Absolutely.
Of course, my discourse on the clitoris, etc., can be accused of essentialism, because it pertains to anatomy, etc., etc. So that And my insistence on the feminine that started in Changing Difference can also be seen as a kind of expression of essentialism. So it's very vital for me to, and precisely this is related to my being a philosopher, to me being a philosopher, that an essence is not, contrarily to what people say, something fixed and solid. An essence is a transformative entity. And what philosophers have called essence is not a substance. It is a principle of transformation that appears very clearly in Hegel in the doctrine of essence. Essence is in between being and the concept as this mediating point that is able to allow for the transformation of being into the concept. So an essence is never a fixed point, but on the contrary, something in becoming, something in something moving. So essentialism, the critique of essentialism, for me, doesn't make any sense. It just translates a profound ignorance of the philosophical terms, ontological terms. So for me to talk about the feminine is perhaps essential, but if we understand essence as a plastic entity, there's no contradiction. The feminine is always the process of its own transformation. Women between themselves, yes, because you have on the, yes, unfortunately, there are many, many conflicts within feminism because some women precisely don't understand what an essence is, and they will insist on the fact that no, there's nothing like the feminine, it doesn't exist because it's an essentialist view. You, on the contrary, have women who declare, no, we affirm the essentiality of the feminine against the masculine. And you have transfeminism that doesn't want to hear about the feminine anymore. So yes, there are unfortunately, I think this is very unfortunate. We have these divisions that all revolve around the concept of essence that remains totally misunderstood. Hence the importance of being a philosopher, you know, sometimes.
Thank you for this. I think that's a very very pointed, that changes for example Freud's idea that anatomy is destiny, right? Well, if anatomy is understood as that kind of essence in becoming, having a plastic structure, so to speak, a structure that is not a structure but historical itself, in becoming itself, or the structure of becoming, if I may put it like this, things get far more complicated and more pointed, and one can actually defend the idea that there is something like, let's say, an essence and a history, as you to move on to another book of yours, namely Morphing Intelligence, as you point out with regard to the concept of intelligence. So intelligence itself seems to, the concept of intelligence seems to have evolved, seems to have an essence in this sense, an essence in becoming.
Yeah, exactly.
So we learn through the history of intelligence that you distinguish into different periods, that intelligence, to really understand what intelligence is, we have to account for intelligence as an intelligence, as something that is in becoming, like is becoming,
yeah.
And transforming itself. I mean, it is part of giving itself a form and receiving a form, to use your, I think, very amazingly, and for that reason, rightly famous definition of what a plastic, or what plasticity is. Can you say a few more words about what your take on intelligence is, especially in the AI discourse, which is everywhere these days? And so universities are very afraid of ChatGPT, for example, I know, as a matter of fact. And how that relates to what we talked about earlier. I mean, I think there's an absolutely red line about the non-principledness or the anarchism that pertains to the practice of transforming intelligence itself.
So, yeah, well, that's of course a very difficult question to the extent that who exactly is able to really grasp what's going on with the development of AI. I think you're totally right to say that intelligence has a plastic development, and essential in the sense we were talking about a minute ago, development, and that in a certain sense, from the beginning of this history, which is psychology of the 19th century, up to what's happening today, there is something that remains, which is that intelligence is very simply defined as problem resolution. Problem resolution by putting together different heterogeneous elements. And intelligence is a capacity, and it exists, of course, in animals also, and perhaps even in plants, to synthesize different elements in order to solve a problem. So, in that sense, an AI system answers, I mean, this definition perfectly. It fits perfectly with this definition. If we think of neural networks or deep learning, so the machine gives itself the means to solve its own problems. So at the same time, what, in my view, what exactly is new in this at the same time in artificial intelligence that was not included in the first definitions? I would say that, in fact, it plays with the end of several dualisms, the model copy one, the signified ones, one, and it puts language in relation with itself. This is very clear with ChatGPT, that learns language by accumulating different languages, different ways of speaking on a non-genetic, in a non-genetic form. ChatGPT is language in relation with itself. It works also with the visuals, its vision in relation with itself. So in that sense, we're getting out of the difference of the difference. This is the end of the reign of difference. So for me, this is something that I've been aware of for a long time when I started challenging the notion of writing in Derrida. I'd say it's the end of difference. But today, I think we are totally into this. And people, the technophobic people, absolutely want to save difference, to say, no, but there's a difference between a human being and a machine. There's no difference. I mean, the difference is getting less and less visible. So it seems to me that the language of objects and language per se have merged. And so, yes, something happens at the level of language, which is that language is canceling its dimension of difference. And that's for me a total revolution. Because until now, linguistics has always proceeded by underscoring differences, signifiers, signified, phonemes, morphemes. That's the end of it. Chomsky was terrified by ChatGPT, saying, "Oh, in an article in the New Yorker, oh, how will we do? We don't have, we cannot, with ChatGPT, sorry, is erasing the genetic acquisition of language, like first phonemes, then morphemes." Yeah, of course, because difference disappears.
Just as a very spontaneous follow-up, would you say thereby what we have to think, therefore, if AI confronts us with a cancellation of difference by means of difference,
Yeah.
do we have to think in difference? Do we have to learn how to think? Yeah, like this self-cancellation
I
of.
wouldn't say indifference.
Yeah.
No. I would say simulation. Yeah, we would have to think what simulation is. And that perhaps precisely it is perhaps not possible to differentiate between what is simulated and what is not, including in the dialogue we're having now.
Okay.
I'm not even sure I'm not simulating my own responses, you know. For the sake of the discussion, you know, in order to be able to say something. I think, and this is with this phenomenon that Trump and people like him are playing, it's impossible to know the truth. Because after all, everything perhaps is just a simulacrum. So I would say it's more that than indifference.
Let's move to a different domain. We want to ask you something. We want to ask you about your philosophical trajectory, so to speak. So when people try to characterize a thinker's work, the temptation is usually to divide it into different different periods.
Yes.
So could you tell us a little bit more how you retrospectively or retroactively perceive your own trajectory? We are asking this because following Derrida, once you said that it's impossible to separate biography or autobiography from and theory. So we're curious about how do you see your own?
But do I have to link it with biographical details?
No, not necessarily. No, no.
Okay. It's strange because, yes, of course, there are different moments for sure. And at the same time, I have the feeling of pursuing the same line. So people say, oh, yeah, that's plasticity. That's her fetish concept. It has nothing to do with that because plasticity is just a key for me, you know. It is just a... Yeah, exactly. Like when I open my door with my key, that's all it is. It's not that important, contrary to what people think. But at the same time, yeah, I have, thanks to this key, perhaps, I have the feeling of walking on the same ground since the beginning, which I think, you know, is the, it took a long time, but I think I'm interested in, what I'm interested in is the absence of masters. So I think you can explain the whole trajectory by the challenging of mastery. First of all, Hegel, writing a thesis on Hegel with Derrida was a way to say, okay, you think you have deconstructed Hegel in Gla, but I will show you that's not the case. By insisting on plasticity in Hegel, I will show Hegel, you're not as master, as powerful as you think, because you need plasticity. So it was a strange dialectical game with the two masters. Then I did the same thing with Heidegger. That was the second phase. Like you, in order to address the question of ontological difference, you need a theory of metamorphosis. It exists in your work, but it's not obvious, and I will make it appear. So it is also a division of the mastery. Then that was, of course, the very important period for me of the brain. What should we do with the brain, but also the new wounded and everything revolving around the new definition of the psyche. That was also a challenge to the mastery of psychoanalysis and challenged the mastery of the mind, of the psyche, and the re-evaluation of an oppressed organ, that was the brain. Then there was the epigenetic moments with the reading of Kant, the rereading of Kant against speculative realism and Meyasu's argument that we could dismiss the transcendental. So this also was a way to challenge Kant's mastery to the extent that if the a priori is malleable in some way, then the critique is fragile. Well, I'm going very, very quickly. And then So there were all the books on feminism, but we already evoked them. They were also in that critique of domination. And then I don't remember, I think anarchism came up. So you see, of course, each of these books has their own autonomy. And at the same time, they are linked, you know, with this question that is very simple. Very simple. Can we do without, you know, Chomsky says, anarchism is very simple. It is no bosses. It's exactly, you know, no boss. Huh? And that's my idea.
I mean, it's quite beautiful how this chimes with the idea. I mean, very early on in your PG thesis, indicate that plasticity is a way of forming a concept of a concept. Right? That is how you enter. It's so you change the idea of a certain of what a concept is. And the concept is not the boss. It becomes a certain form of practice, right?
Yeah, and that's thank you very much for saying this, because I don't mind being a philosopher. Because, you know, some people say it's contradictory to argue that there is no bosses and to be a philosopher. But you're right. For me, a concept is not a master. Definitely not. Mm-hmm. Can be. It can be. I mean, it depends on how, but it's not necessarily one.
No, I mean, it's, and it makes perfect sense to say there is something about the, maybe one could say the modus operandi of the concept, right? Not, or of the essence of the concept, to speak in the way in which we spoke earlier, in which Hegel would himself speak, right? But that everything depends on what that means.
Yeah.
You are one of the few, I think, philosophical thinkers, and this is part of why this conversation is, I think, so fruitful and productive, who, because this podcast is called Philosophy and Its Other Scene, you were never shy of encountering or entering the other scenes. Confronted philosophy with very, very different other territories or terrains all along. We would like to ask you something about contemporary culture, simply because you have yourself evoked sometimes, I think, I mean, literary, or spoken about Pollock, Kafka, Duras, and others. What is your take on, I mean, we're pending the Oscars. What is your take on contemporary film culture? Is there anything that you find interesting or worthwhile in something like, I don't know, Oppenheimer, Barbie, Anatomy of a Fall, or Zone of Interest? Something that I thought was...
Well, no, unfortunately, I don't have a take on that, except that when... in this logic, hyper-capitalistic logic of the industrial culture of movie making, when a movie like The Zone of Interest or Anatomy of a Fall can emerge, that's for me something interesting. That's for me an event, because it shouldn't have, you know, when you see what kind of film is triumphing. So there's hope. But I don't know. I don't have much to say about that. What is your take on it? Maybe you give me ideas.
No, I mean, for the Zone of Interest, I was quite displeased with. I thought the ending was horrible, but there is something about organizing a form of life.
In the
family
in the...
life.
Yes, of course. I mean, yeah,
reproductive life.
Close
to an extermination site, and there is something to what how one gets habituated to this, and how this becomes.
Yeah, and how it illustrates perfectly our world.
Yeah. No, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. No, but now we are talking about the content of the movies. But how do you see, what is your take on the Oscars themselves? I mean, the ceremony, etc.
I mean, maybe it's rather why we bring this up is, it is the festival of dominant culture, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I know that Slavoj has a very funny way of analyzing those things, but he has a talent that I don't have. I listened recently to what he said about Taylor Swift, and it was so funny when she showed naked and on the. But I mean, this is Slavoj. You know, I don't have this talent, unfortunately. You know.
Well, Frank and I also have usually a bet on the Oscars, who's going to win, and we are still set to do it. So yeah. Well, let's move to yet another scene. Could you tell us a little bit, like your analysis of the contemporary world? The present situation seems to us to be in a way that not so really surprising. The war has become a crucial determining factor. This could seem reminiscent of the situation a century ago. We are thinking of the Great War, the anniversary of the beginning of the Great War. What is your take on the contemporary political global, if you may ask this so broadly, situation and the escalation that we see see everywhere and that seem to create increasingly problematic potentials, so to speak?
I'm really struck by the part played by death today. On the one hand, we are part of this civilized world, so to speak, in which the individual won't ever accept to sacrifice itself to anything. And we had thinkers like Nancy, who recently said that sacrifice had disappeared from our world. So we have, on the one hand, people who refuse to die, who refuse to sacrifice themselves, who are unable to understand how one can go to war for principles or for defending values. So on the one hand, we are all what Nietzsche called the last man, that is totally selfish, refusing death or reducing it to a biological reality, hiding it in hospitals, and unable to, yes, to believe in a kind of collective action. And on the other, we see death everywhere. We are witnessing what we might call the redeployment of death in all its forms, with the images of Gaza, of course, but also the victims of the Ukraine war, the tortures of Russian dissenters, etc. So we are, on the one hand, indifferent to death, trying to relegate it to nothing. And on the other, we are assaulted with images of death as if death was, yes, redeploying itself as a reality. And in fact, what we do, I was thinking of that in the West, is that it's, you know, it's like in the bridge game. We are playing the part of the dead, meaning we don't want to hear about death, so we behave as if we were dead already. Like unable to respond to the challenges of today's situation, unable to answer, unable to respond to the Gaza genocide, unable to take a clear position vis-à-vis Ukraine, unable to oppose anything to Putin. So we are, it seems to me that we should write a new chapter of Freud's thoughts for the time of war and death. We are paralyzed with death. Huh? We don't know what to do with it anymore. I mean, yeah, we've lost any sense of sacrifice, or as I said, any sense of exposure to it. Huh? We hide it all the time. And at the same time, we're overwhelmed by it. And this is very difficult to, to assimilate. And for me, it seems to me that all the politicians are, like zombies, dead people. We die in life, so to speak, because we're unable to address the challenge of this redeployment of death. I don't know if I'm clear, but I was thinking of Freud very much those last days, the magnificent text about war.
And it's the anniversary, right? I mean, of that.
Oh, really?
Text. Of that text, if I'm not mistaken.
Maybe 1924. Great.
Against this background and vis-a-vis your, because one of the heroic elements in your thought is, I mean, as you endorsed earlier, you're not shy of saying that you're a philosopher. In some sense, that philosophy.
No, matters, not shy at all. No.
And this is what one cannot but love, and should. But it raises maybe the question: what against the background, like our historical background, and a background that sees transformations in pertaining to the concept of intelligence, something like ChatGPT, on all these fronts, things seem to be changing. What is the task of philosophy in all that? According to you, what would you say? What can philosophy do? I mean, we're almost going full circle to the theory practice question at the beginning. What can philosophy do? What does?
I mean, I would answer negatively. If philosophy wasn't able to do anything, then we wouldn't see all philosophy departments closing. I mean, if philosophy was really impotent and unimportant and nobody would care about suppressing the departments, you know, clearly today there's a kind of genocide of theory. I can't think of another word. It's clearly a mass killing of all forms of critical thinking, and of course philosophy is included. So there must be a reason for that. As we said before the interview, the reason cannot be only economic, because it doesn't cost much to have a philosophy department open in a university. It is clearly a political stance. And if philosophy couldn't do anything, then people wouldn't care. So the attack on thinking today is a resistance, is a way to show that philosophy is extremely important. Because if we had the means as philosophers to speak freely, to have a larger audience, to not be restricted by finances, by budgets, et cetera, we might perhaps know how to talk to people and create forms of resistance. So I'm not... I don't belong to the movement of the pessimists relatively vis-a-vis philosophy, you know, on the contrary. And if we see, you know, all these shit books, like, you know, like popular philosophy about, oh, what is happiness? It's because these are ideological coverings of real philosophy that I'm sure is considered very dangerous. If you go to Russia and you try to, develop some kinds of philosophical discourses against domination, the kind of dialogue we have here, we would go to jail immediately. So you see.
And to really conclude, and the last question really connects very well to what you've been saying just now, dear Catherine. Okay. Over a decade ago, you said something like, I'm not really optimistic, but at the same time, I'm very excited by what happens today. How do you feel today? Optimistic or excited? Or you don't feel either nor of these?
Well, so optimistic, no. Pessimistic, yeah, on many levels, of course, relatively to what you were saying a moment ago about wars, etc. How not to be pessimistic, but at the same time, excited, for sure. For sure. Because I don't know, I still feel the energy. You know, I still feel that something in this world, in spite of all the catastrophes, is still vibrating. I mean, there's an energy to for thinking, energy for creating, for, you know, yeah, building, resisting. So excited for sure.
We usually end the podcast with a slightly silly exercise, and that's an either or exercise. You don't have to opt for either or. You can deny both or opt for either. But anyhow, okay. And you can elucidate why you choose what you choose, but you don't absolutely don't have to. People have responded very differently, and it's usually quite interesting to see how. So,
are there always the same questions?
No. We model them and transform them each and every time. I'm just going to read it out, and you do with them what you do. The first one would be Derrida or Nancy.
Derrida.
Construction or dialectic.
Dialectics.
Agamben or Foucault.
Foucault.
Psychoanalysis or gender theory.
Psychoanalysis.
Law or justice.
Law or justice. Justice.
Film or literature?
Oh no, this one is terrible.
I know.
Literature.
Sex or gender?
Gender.
And the last one, organization or association?
This one is the worst. organized associations.
That's absolutely lovely. Thank you so much, Catherine.
No, thank
it was
you.
Absolutely fantastic.
Thank you so much. We really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for doing it with us.